One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the show. My guest today, Jacob Hawley, started his stand-up career at the tender age of 21 and in the last 4 years has gone on to perform hundreds of gigs all across the country. Finalist in the BBC New Comedy Awards of 2017 from a field of roughly 700 hopefuls down to the final six, which in the past has been the achievement of many well-known British greats such as Peter Kay, Alan Carr and Lee Mack, among others. Jacob has also won the King Gong Award at the Comedy Store here in London, and at just 25 has proven he's well on his way to establishing himself as a regular face in comedy here in the city and hopefully worldwide eventually. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I thought we could start off with a bit of a moan. As I say, I did like a little bit of research, and just recently I've had the worst food poisoning in my entire life.
Have you actually?
Yeah, like literally just the other day. And
do you mind me asking, which day was it? Because I had food poisoning last week.
On Thursday night,
right.
I was at Honest Burger in Shoreditch.
Okay.
And I had this dodgy burger and I just got turned inside out for the next 24 hours.
Jeez.
And I was always one of these people that said it was bollocks beforehand kind of thing. Don't worry about sell-by dates and all that kind of stuff. And so I thought, I noticed that you'd had a similar experience and thought I'd give you the opportunity to publicly shame whoever is responsible.
I will publicly shame myself.
Oh, really?
Poison myself. Yeah, I came back from holiday and I had some reduced mints. And the saving that I made on that mince was not worth the next 48 hours, let me tell you that.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. And it's not even the first time I've done it. I've poisoned myself with rice before.
Right.
Genuinely, I've had a very embarrassing incident at a Jamie T concert. Where I had to leave very quickly because, earlier in the day...
It comes on quick, doesn't it?
It does come on quick. And you know what? At that concert, I remember, I thought I'd had my drink spiked. Because you go so lightheaded and fevery. I genuinely thought, I'd accidentally taken something.
Yeah.
And, at first I was like, oh, this is all right, actually. And then obviously it's not all right, and yeah.
Yeah, next thing, you're lying on the ground, like, kind of...
Yeah.
Holding your stomach, Jeez. Really struggling.
Yeah.
So I'll start off on your journey back at university. So I believe you went to Middlesex, and a little fact that I found particularly interesting was that you wanted to do stand-up comedy, and so you decided to establish the Comedic Society for your university.
Middlesex Comedy Society.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, the fact that you had the initiative to go and create this thing, and I wondered if you could maybe expand on it. How did... that go, building that thing? Was it successful by the end of it?
We won an award, actually. I forget, what did we win an award for? I think we won an award for maybe Best Student Activity or Best Student Event. It was something... So, I mean, within comedy, the Student Comedy Society is like a well-trodden path towards doing stand-up. So particularly at Cambridge University, that's probably the best example. So Cambridge University has the Footlights Society, as it's called. And that is, you know, a full institution now. That they are every year they're at the Edinburgh Fringe and other other festivals. I think recently they toured around America. You know, every year and it's very well structured. They have a president, a treasurer. They have people that take it in turns. They have stand ups. They do plays. They do all sorts. So it's me, and it was my mate Dave Duckworth. We were both quite keen on comedy. We'd done sort of comedy acting. I'd obviously wanted to do stand-up for a long time, wanting to start doing it. So we set up the Middlesex Comedy Society. We managed to get about 10 or 12 other people. And these were various people who either people who wanted to do sketches or people who were interested in trying stand-up. And so we'd sort of meet and we'd sort of, you know, practice stand-up. And that's when I started at 21. I didn't really start on the circuit until I was about 22. So I've only really been on the circuit for about 3 years. But yeah, I started doing the Middlesex Comedy Society. And we set it up, and it was, you know, the, compared to what I've heard about Footlights and other university comedy societies, I mean, we were a shambles, you know. And what I really underestimated is that no one else really wanted to do stand-up as much as me and Dave did.
Was Dave good?
Yeah, Dave was great. He was brilliant. There was most of the shows he was you know the best one on. He was fantastic, and he was really good because he was great at just bouncing off the audience, and he still is. He's a really naturally funny person. But it was just kind of us dragging other people to do something that they probably weren't, you know, they probably said they were up for it at a party or something and then weren't really that into it. But we'd still, you know, we still had the administrative endeavour.
And you managed to pull in an audience.
Yeah, we did. And that's something we did really well. I think it's just because we had quite a captive audience because obviously we were on a theatre arts course, so they, you know, everyone was kind of interested in seeing that kind of thing anyway. A lot of the people that were involved in the society, myself definitely not included in this, but a lot of them were quite popular on the course, so they could sort of pull friends in. So me and Dave founded that. It died. When we left, and I really wish we could have left something that would have at least, you know, just giving people an opportunity. Because, like I said, I mean, the thing with the comedy industry at the moment is that there are too many performers, not enough audience, not enough clubs. And that is what's running it makes the industry so difficult to make it work for yourself, especially in terms of making a living. Whereas in that microcosm, you know, at our university and in terms of that society, it's the only place in the world where it's the complete opposite. There's loads of people up for watching comedy. There just wasn't enough people who wanted to see it. And, it, you know, anyone else would have said, oh, you know, who cares? I'll just do an hour. You know, we didn't have the materials to do that, and we didn't have the skill to do that. Thank God we didn't try. But that was my first kind of go at it before I went out and got on the circuit, so to speak.
Successful first step. You said that you've always wanted to be a comedian. I just wondered if you could kind of give us a little insight into what your life was like growing up. You know, like how did comedy play a role in your family scenario, for example?
I think when I say that I've always wanted to be a comedian, it probably makes people think I'm a lot more damaged than I actually am. my dad was really into comedy. My dad, he's into Monty Python and all that kind of stuff. So he would always have me watching stuff like that. Fawlty Towers, I remember as well. We used to have a caravan we used to go to on holiday. We had a caravan by the south coast and we used to go there, and we'd go there for the whole 6 weeks of the summer holidays. And my mum...
Where in the south coast after?
It was sort of between two little towns called Hythe and Dymchurch.
Right.
So it's kind of near Folkestone.
Right.
So me and my sister would go down there with my mum, and we'd stay there for the whole 6 weeks, and my dad would come on weekends. And like sort of Friday night, the excitement would extend as far as having fish and chips and then my dad putting on Fawlty Towers or something like that, and I'd sort of lay on the floor in hysterics laughing at it. Getting a bit older, I mean, my first sort of exposure to stand-up, I was on a camping holiday with one of my mates and his girlfriend, and we were quite young, we were only about sort of 12 or 13, and she lent me her iPod and she had like a DVD rip of Ricky Gervais's Politics Show. And that was my first time I'd ever really been exposed to stand-up at all. And I was just hooked. And I couldn't believe how much I liked it. And I would listen to it like music, and I would learn every single word and every beat to it as if it was a song. And I'd play it to people as if it was music as well and expect them to sort of, you know, and obviously stand-up out of context is the worst thing in the world, so it wouldn't get a very good reaction. But so, yeah, that's sort of how I first got into it. And I always really liked the idea of you know, like what Ricky Gervais did in terms of becoming like a writer performer. So having the writing ability to do sitcoms and also being able to do stand up. And I think when I got to the age that I was looking at university courses, I was sort of the sort of thing I sort of tried to decide was whether I wanted to learn to perform or whether I wanted to learn to write. And I think the way that I went, I probably learned to perform more than I learned to write. And that's something now that I'm sort of catching up on.
It actually leads into my next question with you, which was, so the first time I actually watched you perform, it was at the Secret Comedy Club. I was there with my girlfriend.
Top Secret,
like really good club. It tends to be where I've been in the past. And you know, you looked like a younger guy. You took the piss out of yourself for being a younger guy.
Yeah.
The one thing I was really impressed with was just how much presence you had on stage. And, like, you know, you seemed to be extremely confident. You played the audience. And it, you know, it's hard enough for people to just do public speaking, let alone stand-up comedy. And because you started so young, I just wondered where that manifested. Like, how did that come about for you to be so prolific at it at such an early stage?
I think you just, it's, I mean, here's the thing. When I started, you know, like I said, I was sort of 21 when I started doing it, and I was 22 when I sort of started doing proper gigs outside the university. And I thought that was really young. Now I know people who started at sort of 15 or 16 or something insane like that. There's a guy who I know who I really like called Ahir Shah. He was nominated for the Best Newcomer Award at Edinburgh this year, and he's incredible, right? And he is so, you know, he's so far ahead of me. Like he's so, and I'm not saying in terms of achievement, he is in terms of achievement, but he's so good. And he's literally, I think he's like 6 months older than me or something depressing like that. But he has got like something like, he started insanely young. And it's, I think more and more nowadays, you're getting a lot of people starting an awful lot younger.
Even if it's in front of a camera at home, right? On YouTube or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose that's the next thing. I suppose that is the way it's going.
I heard a thing the other day that all the American comedians that are attached to HBO or something are each launching their own podcast, you know, as a way to have that continued audience development with their fan base and all that kind
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's effectively a grown-up version of a YouTube show, right? It's like a way for you to be on the airwaves and for people to hear you.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing with that, I think, is, you're trying to build a following, right? I think for most of us, that's what we're trying to do. And I think, I was talking to another comedian about this because sometimes that's kind of happened with the two of us. You know, sometimes I'll be lucky enough that someone will have enjoyed what I've done at a show, and they'll come up to me afterwards and say, "Oh, I really enjoyed that." And you know, obviously, in the moment, you're just really thankful and really grateful, and it's a really nice feeling. But at the back of your mind, there's that business thought of, okay, how do I hold? No, but there is. Is it? How do I hold on to this person?
Yeah.
How do I? You know, make this part of an audience that I'm building. And I think the thing with that is, like you say, you constantly have to be giving something.
Yeah.
You know, and whether that's, you know, it's just not practical for people can't come and watch you every week, but yet you need to be giving them something every week for them to be,
invested.
Yeah,
in you.
Invested in it. And I suppose like a sort of active consumer of your product.
There's a chap called Kevin Kelly, a tech guy, and he refers to it as the 1,000 true fans. So, assuming that those 1,000 true fans, you could foreseeably sell something that was worth £100 to them per year,
right,
or less than that, you know, that you've got a sustainable business model there, just delivering to those 1,000 people that love what you create and do.
Yeah.
So effectively, you're trying to kind of convert those people to, oh, great, you like my stuff. Well, you know, follow me more. And
Exactly. And Stuart Lee, comedian, he said something very, I think when he sort of started rebuilding himself at the start of the last decade, he sort of said, if I have 5,000 people around the UK who are happy to spend £10 a year to come and see me once, that's a career. And it, and like you say about the sort of the podcast and you know, with the Americans, don't get me wrong, the British stand-ups are doing it as well. You know, what do you make to give people every week? Do you make sketches? Do you have a funny Twitter account that people can follow and, you know, engage with? And you know, don't get me wrong, say all these kind of terms like engage and active consumer, all these, you know, it does make me feel a bit sick, to be honest. But it's part of the game, and it's especially nowadays. But yeah, I think you do have to have something to give people, and that's still something that personally I'm trying to work out. I don't know what that is for me yet, and it's something that I want to work out soon, because I think especially, so I did Edinburgh this year, and you know, after each Edinburgh show, you really do feel like, especially when you have a good show, you feel like, what do I do now to make sure that these people...
You've got that moment in time, you know, that captive audience of that moment. If you don't convert them then and there, the chances of those people becoming in that circle or whatever is is slim.
Yeah.
So there has to be some form of mechanic where you can kind of, whether it's they come to you or whether you capture their stuff somehow, you know.
I think that's it, and I think that's I think especially nowadays it's becoming more like, it's becoming more of a two-way thing now. And I think you see that a lot more with people. And I suppose this is quite a it's quite a sort of global thing, and it's something that affects anyone who, you know, again using these terms, but anyone who sort of anyone who creates content is trying to find the best way of producing enough content that people can engage with and blah blah blah. But yeah, I think it is becoming more of a two-way thing. I think people are becoming more interactive with the content that they consume. I sound like I work in marketing. I don't know where I pick up all these words.
Well, it's, you know, it's like you say, it's part of what you've got to do. But let's maybe shift it back to your stuff. So in a recent interview, I heard you say that in your very first performance that your material was a little bit more ambitious because it dealt with subjects like religion and paedophilia. And I wondered what it was that made
I wasn't that... drawing... I promised that I didn't draw a link between the two. That's, no. That's what I would say.
I was curious to know, you know, what makes that subject matter more ambitious, in your opinion, than what you maybe do now?
I'm not sure that I necessarily think it's more ambitious than what I do now, but I think certainly at the time I didn't want to go out and talk about subjects that I thought were, you know, sort of hack and boring, you know, whether that's stuff that's sort of unnecessarily blue or, you know, dating apps or whatever. And I don't think that I've moved on to that at all. I think I've just learned how to speak about things that I care about in a language that suits me. You know, so I think now, and this is going to sound incredibly pretentious, but now I try and talk about class, nationalism, in terms that I can speak in. So through anecdotes and through past experiences and through, you know, things that are more relevant to me. Whereas when I started, I just wanted to go out and tell people, you know, what's wrong with religion and, you know, make ironic jokes about disabled people. I do have to stress there. Right? Yeah, but yeah, because I just watched a lot of Ricky Gervais and I'd watched a lot of Russell Brand, and people like that who are very good at talking about quite serious things and saying things that are potentially quite controversial, but in a way that's obviously ironic, so it's, you know, it's funny.
Well, I've got a little list for you here, because this is a subject which is so prevalent right now, which is that there's between the left and the right, there's extremities and people who are typically liberal and left, mm-hmm. They're kind of so far leaning that they're actually squelching on free speech, which would be something that they would be more for than anyone in theory. So, you know, subjects that people struggle with, assimilation, religion, gender, cultural differences, politics, sex, sexual orientation, war. But it's kind of, do you see it as your role as a comedian to be that cultural provocateur, to be able to voice those things in an environment that people aren't going to take seriously, or has that backfired in the past?
I think it has backfired in the past. I think that's the reason there are people that are uncomfortable with it. It's because in the past it has been. I mean, you know, we're talking about my first gig, and I'm sure that I did it in a very heavy-handed way, in a way that, you know, I don't think I upset anyone, but potentially could have done. And I think that's possibly where it's gone wrong in the past, is that people have done it in a way that hasn't been particularly sensitive and hasn't. And I think the problem nowadays is that performance used to exist in isolation and within the context of that performance itself, and it used to live in that context and it used to die in that context. If you've come and seen me at Top Secret, you know, and years ago that performance would have been in isolation of its own performance, I could have said something that written down would have looked absolutely horrendous, but within the context of that room, you know, either based on something that had happened in the room or something that someone had already said in the room, it could be perfectly acceptable, where everyone's in on the joke and we all had a good time. Whereas you could write it down, take it away, and it could sound awful. Nowadays it's difficult because everything has the potential to be filmed, everything has the potential to be written down. All it takes is for someone to write a tweet saying, I went to see a comedian, he said this, and it spirals out of everything else. I think with all those subjects, all you can do is just try and. For me personally, if I don't feel I'm personally informed on a subject and I don't feel the subject really affects me, I don't really see why I need to speak about it. That's not to say that I'm not allowed to speak about it, but I just personally don't think. And also, I think a lot of the time nowadays, people confuse being prosecuted in terms of their speech with being told to shut up. So, you know, me saying something horrendous on stage about whatever religion, and then 1,000 people attacking me on Twitter about it, that's still not me being prosecuted. That's not the police turning up at my door. That's just other people's free speech to call me an idiot, which is fine. That's still me having free speech. You know, I've personally, as a comedian, I've never really felt that my free speech is being taken away from me, or that I feel like I'm in a... There are clubs that I do that I know are slightly more sensitive and are slightly more squeamish, and that I shouldn't say certain things. You know, sometimes that's frustrating. Sometimes you wish you could be a bit more ballsy in what you talk about. Am I allowed to swear, by the way?
Yeah, of course. All
right, okay. So, sorry, I should have asked that before. There are clubs that are a little bit more squeamish, but then there's some that aren't. And I'd like to think there is still a place and a context where you can talk about all the subjects that you listed there and you won't have people get upset or get offended. I'd also like to think that if you do talk about those things and people do get upset and get offended, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it's good. Like on a slightly different tangent, but playing on another facet of stand-up comedy, and you kind of briefly mentioned it, I think, before we started recording, which is the fact that you wanted to do it since you can remember, for example.
Yeah, for a long time.
And saying that... maybe people think you're in a worse place than you are, like psychologically or whatever, because there is that association with stand-up comedy that you think so much about the world around you that actually you can end up in a very depressive place, and that's a part of it to some degree. When you're thinking about what life's all about, and then you realise, you know what, it's like there is no official meaning for a lot of people, so why not just take the piss out of it and have a laugh?
Yeah.
Is that been an experience for you? Do you find that some people are quite neurotic in the
yeah,
biz?
Yeah, of course. But I mean, you probably get a bit of that in every industry. But of course, it's prone to that. It encourages a sort of introspection, and you know, it encourages you to really take in things around. And I suppose in some instances, that probably I've personally count myself as quite lucky in that my mental health hasn't really, I don't think, maybe it has, but I don't think it's been too badly blighted by what I do with stand-up. But there's every reason why it would. I mean, it's not a healthy thing to do, is it? To stand there, you know, bare all, be quite honest in front of hundreds of people, and the reaction to it to be so visceral and immediate, you know, that can be a very difficult thing to deal with. And I completely empathise with anyone who does have, who does get down. And you would get down about it. And I'm not saying that I don't get down because I don't have bad gigs. Of course I have bad gigs. But it's, I don't know, I'm just quite fortunate in that I've got nice people around me. I've got nice people that I work with regularly in terms of stand-up and comedy that, you know, can sort of just give me a pat on the back and say, don't worry, you know, tomorrow's a new gig. But I think, you know, there are a lot of people who it can really... It's a very open place to be. It's a very lonely place to be as well.
Well, I was on that, I think that when... A massive part of comedy is you being able to observe stuff, and almost from an outside perspective. So you're looking at the world around you and going, you know, what are these interactions that are going on here? What's funny about it? What are some of the things that people just take for granted that actually there's something different and weird about it? And that naturally is going to exclude you from being in it, I guess.
Yeah, naturally, I think it does. And I think that's. For me personally, that's where I've found that I draw a lot of material from is situations where I do feel more like an outsider. There's you know, when I look at what I write about, and when I look at what I sometimes struggle to write about, some of the stuff that I really struggle to write about is stuff where I don't feel as much of an outsider. Do you know what I mean? So the times when I do feel more in the moment and more caught up with things, that's kind of they're the sort of scenarios that are sometimes difficult, more difficult to write about.
or more difficult to have a fresh angle on because you are just within it and you are just enjoying it. Whereas I suppose the situations where you do feel a bit more like an outsider, they just naturally lend to observation. And so they're usually the most sort of fruitful topics to pick in my experience. I think you do get there is definitely a spectrum in that in terms of comedians. There are some comedians who the way they present themselves on stage is so far towards that level of being an outsider. You know, Angelos Epithemiou, Brian Gittins, for example. They are outsiders to the extreme. But then you get other comedians where you maybe not say that's the case. You know, who are more sort of everyman kind of comedians. You sort of Jason Manfords and your McIntyres and stuff who. Probably
Mickey Flanagan, would he be in it?
Flynn. But they're not people that who you'd necessarily describe as outsiders, but what they're really good at is picking out and describing the sort of really minute details within social situations that are funny.
Yeah, there was one chap at Secret Comedy Club, and obviously I'm not going to try and tell his jokes, I would fuck it right up. but he was talking about how basically for him, when the sun came out, it was like it was leading people, pulling them to the park and pinning them down to the ground. So you lie there and you soak in the sun. And I could tell that this guy was just like such an outsider, you know, he's just proper loner.
Yeah.
From the jokes were all these things that we all take for granted and actually quite enjoy. And he was kind of saying, this stuff that you do, that you love, it's ridiculous. And I was loving it. But I could tell, I felt kind of sorry for the dude because the room wasn't on his side, but I felt like, you know, like he's funny. But.
Yeah, definitely. And you see that a lot. And I think that some of the really, like the most interesting comedians are the ones who can have those gigs and perhaps only connect with 20 or 30% of the people in the room, but kind of have the sort of strength and the balls to stick with it. And to persevere. And I think especially, you know, think about it from an audience point of view with that. That's probably for you. It probably feels a little bit more special to be part of that 20% of the room who really enjoyed that joke and who really got that joke. And that's probably why that comics material has stuck with you a bit more than when you're in a room and you're just part of the 100% who are all on board with it. And I think that's where a lot of the most interesting and alternative comedy comes from. It's the people who are happy to just connect with 20% of the room. And that 20% will come out and go, well, it feels like I'm part of this sort of exclusive club who are the only people who get this woman or this man's jokes. And it creates a more kind of intimate way of enjoying that comedy.
That's going back to being a marketers for a minute. Yeah. That's where you get your
the people. I'll tell you what, when I give up on comedy, I'm going to be a great agent.
Yeah, there you go, sorted. Talking about other comedians, from an outsider perspective, comedians have this aura of like indestructibility about them. They're so fast, and you kind of obviously there's the few brave hecklers that kind of give it some, but everyone else is a bit more intimidated because they assume they're going to get torn to shreds or whatever. In my experience, the few that I've spoke to, like yourself, have all been really friendly. But what is the actual community like once you're in it? Is there any diva-ishness
Of course. I mean, there's a very broad spectrum of personalities, and you know, 90% of people are absolutely lovely. I think what you do find in this might be London, but with London there is an extensive kind of open mic circuit, and that is you know the sort of first rung on the ladder, and that's you know sort of. Entry level, you know, when you start performing, they're the sort of the open mic nights are the nights that you start at, and they will have sort of, you know, anywhere between 15 and 25 comedians on a bill doing sort of 5 minutes each. They're usually very new comedians. The audience numbers tend to be quite low, and I think that circuit has got a slight level of there were one or two characters on that circuit. They're a bit bitter and a bit. I mean, I especially felt as a new comic who was quite, you know, like I say, quite young, not the youngest, but quite young. I did, you know, it's a bit intimidating. And, you know, definitely when I started, there were a few people that I'd feel really intimidated at gigs sometimes just by some of the personalities in the room. And it can be quite clicky. But as soon as you get out of those rooms and onto the, you know, into more positive environments, everyone's lovely. Literally everyone's lovely. And it, you know, all the way up to really, you know, pretty big names. I mean, I did a gig with. I was really lucky. I got to do a gig with Kevin Bridges,
And he's someone who I remember watching years and years ago on my parents' computer, watching him do his first live at the Apollo, and I absolutely adored it, and I loved it, and it, you know, and I was so sort of excited to perform on the same bill as him, and it was in a club in Kingston upon Thames called Outside the Box. It's a great little club run by a guy called Matt Brown, and he's a fantastic, hilarious comedian himself. But so Kevin Bridges was on, and there was a few of us, and I think we were all a bit excited to be on the same bill as him. And we were in the green room. I say the green room. It's three sheets that are hanging in the corner of the room that the comedian's standing before going on stage. And he came in, and he just introduced himself to absolutely everyone. You know, he said, "Oh, hi, I'm Kevin. How are you? How long have you been going?" Blah, 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 as if we didn't know who he was. And then afterwards, he was nice enough to put a nice tweet about us all, sent me a nice message on Twitter, and he managed to get me a couple of gigs with his management company. And so there's loads and loads of different examples of that, of really, really good people who don't need to be the nicest guy in the room, but they frequently are. And I think there's definitely an element of that, and it's probably in loads of industries where the nicest people do tend to get up the ladder a little bit quicker just because they're better to work with. And I think that's a nice reward to the nicer people. But yeah, most of the people within the industry are really, really nice people. And that's not just performers as well. Like promoters get a bad name. I don't really know why. I think there's this kind of myth that promoters just sort of take all the ticket money and don't give it to the acts. I think in reality, promoters have got one of the most thankless jobs in our industry. You know, they're not getting the buzz from going. I'm sure they get a buzz from running their gigs, but they're not getting the same kind of buzz that we get going on stage. They're, you know, in any kind of live entertainment industry is incredibly difficult nowadays. You know, you're competing against absolutely everything. That, you know, it's more expensive to run nights, everything like that, and they get a bad rep. Most of the promoters I can think of, I have a great relationship with. They're incredibly helpful. I mean, some of the people that I first worked with in terms of promoters were so helpful to me. You know, really went out of their way to say, you know, if you ever want to go for a beer and just have a chat about stuff, you know, cool. A guy called Bobby Carroll was great for that. He run Comedy Nights, and they did a competition that I sort of got into the final of in my first year, and I was a bit too new for it, really. I didn't really know what I was doing. And he sort of took me aside, and, you know, he'd take me for loads of beers and loads of chats, and he was great. And, so most people in the industry are absolutely lovely. I think the same as everything else, you get a few nutters. And you're always gonna. And I think, especially with what we do, it encourages it a bit. But most of the people are really nice.
In the second section of the interview, I wanted to talk to Jacob about the craft of stand-up. There's a perception that comedians are all naturally funny, but it's my assumption that actually a lot of work goes into the writing and delivery of comedic performance. And I wanted to hear Jacob's approach and advice when it came to coming up with ideas and performing. Just to delve into some of the kind of craft elements and, like you say, on the writing side and what you do when you're not on stage. First off, do you actually think you need to be naturally funny to be a great comedian?
I think you know, naturally funny as a term itself is there's so many different ways of understanding that. Most of the people I know who are some of the best comedians are not necessarily the most sort of outwardly funny people when you meet them face to face. That's not to say they're not funny, but it's just not to say that they're not usually the people that make the most effort to be the funniest person in the room. I think joke writing is definitely something you can learn, and I think definitely more recently that there's more people who are putting more time into teaching that as a craft as well as learning it, so that you really can learn how to write comedy now without being a, you know, what people would perceive as a naturally funny person. And then the flip side of that, there are people who don't necessarily write in that way, who are purely improvisational on stage and are absolutely hilarious. So there really are a range of approaches, but I don't think you need to be the person. Yeah, a lot of people who start doing comedy say, "Oh, my friends have told me to do comedy for ages." There's loads of people whose friends would never even dream of them ever doing comedy who become the best comedians. And, from having an analytical mind, from having a good eye for structure and for patterns in terms of joke writing. I think anyone could do it, really.
On the subject of actually wanting to be known for something, for having a niche. Earlier you mentioned that you might only resonate with 20 people in the 20% of the room, for example. Yeah. Do you think being like myself, a British white guy that is, you know, just one of the masses in you know, there's not an angle that you can go on. Like oftentimes when you see comedians, they'll go on their heritage or you know, their own personal experiences that have been a little bit more, they've been more different from the people that they're performing to.
Yeah.
Do you find that as something that could hold you back, or that could make it difficult to kind of make a name for yourself, or to give you a differentiation above around your peers?
I think it works both ways. I think there. Don't get me wrong, every time I sit in front of a notepad, I wish I was more interesting. And I wish, you know, every time I sit in front of a notepad, I wish I was more exotic and I wish I was more interesting. And I wish that the way that I find my angle on things was a bit more obvious. But then at the same time, when I look at a panel show, there are three or four white guys in their 20s or 30s that I look and I go, oh, I could be like him, I could be like him. Whereas traditionally, for women, for people of colour, sometimes people who are gay, if they're looking at that same panel show, they might only see one person, and they could go, "Oh, that's where my voice is represented. There's only one person doing that." So I'm all for more diversity within comedy and more voices, and I wish my voice was more diverse. I think what I'm getting better at as I do it longer is finding what is interesting about my voice and what things I can talk about that are maybe a bit different to what other people have done. Because, you know, without wanting to sound too cliche, everyone's got some kind of unique angle. Everyone's got a way of thinking about something that's slightly different to the norm. And I think, I'm getting better at learning what mine is, and I think I'm starting to. I think within comedy, my background is more different than usual. You know, that what I've found within comedy is that most people have a lot more money than me. You know, and come from a background where they're slightly better spoken or better educated or you know, better off. so that's, you know, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying that I'm not part of the privileged elite. I very much feel like I am. But I think, you know, like I say, I'm getting better at learning what my interests and angle on things are.
When it actually comes to writing your jokes, I assume that once you've written them, that you'll then mess around with structure and that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What's that process for you? What does that look like?
It starts with like a kind of simple idea. And what I usually try and do is if I'm just trying to make a point, if I've just got a statement that I want to get across, you know, for example, saying, hey, look at this thing, that's a bit ridiculous, isn't it? I usually try and frame it within some kind of anecdote. So for example, I've got a bit of material about St. George's Day, which is basically about that it's a bit silly, that it's something that's strangely lauded by nationalists, and it's based on something that definitely isn't true. If I just say it like that, that's not very funny. What basically spawned the idea for that bit of material is I was on the internet, and I was probably on like Britain First or one of those silly Facebook pages, just because I just quite like to read stuff like that every now and then, even though it's something I don't agree with, so I just find it quite funny. and I saw a guy on there who, you know, someone had basically put it to him that the whole St. George's Day thing is obviously not true. Most of you aren't even religious, and yet you celebrate it like a cup final. And, you know, there was no dragon, there was no George, blah, blah, blah. And this guy was arguing back, saying there was, you know, and even if it wasn't a dragon, it might not have been a lizard. It might have been a lizard. Who cares? He's still a saint. But to sort of tell that story like that isn't very interesting. So I frame it in a different way. I say that my dad had a St. George's Day party, and at that party, I had that interaction with someone. Within, you know, and that in itself is maybe slightly better as a joke, you know, to say that I, you know, my dad had a St. George's Day party, I went there, I got an argument with a guy about the legitimacy of St. George's Day, and he argued that maybe St. George didn't kill a dragon, maybe it was a lizard, who cares, it's still a saint. But then within that, to make it funnier, I put a level of jeopardy in there by saying my dad threw that St. George's Day party after forgetting my birthday. So then I've got an angle on that. I've got an emotion to carry throughout that.
So just for people that are listening, you've just said anecdotes, jeopardy. Like, what are some of the things, I'm guessing, that kind of rug pulls or like switches or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah, so like pullback and reveal kind of jokes, stuff like that.
Can you like reel them off the top of your head at all? Like, those,
yeah,
those different techniques?
I can give examples. So, I mean, I've got a bit of material that's probably quite a... Probably quite a formulaic pullback and reveal joke. So a pullback and reveal joke is kind of where you lead the audience down one path and then you pull back and reveal that they were actually on a different path all along. So the joke that I do, I talk about how I look quite young. I tell an anecdote of how I was doing a gig. I went to the gig. I asked the barman for a drink. The barman wouldn't serve me because he thought I was under 18. I had an argument with the barman because behind the bar there was a poster for the night I'm doing with my face on it. I point that out. I say, oh, I'm one of the comedians, so I'm obviously over 18. He looks at me and says, good try. Right? And then I go into this sort of, rant about how, you know, what does this guy think I'm doing? I'm either pretending to be a comedian just to get a drink from a bar, or I actually am a 17-year-old boy who's gone all the way to a comedy club, pretended to be a comedian, risk getting on stage just to pay £4.50 for an overpriced drink.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the joke, I say, anyway, he fell for it. I had my first beer and it was the best 17th birthday ever.
Yeah.
So it's a pullback and reveal, revealing that I actually was 17 all along, stuff like that. So that's kind of one sort of formula you can go down for jokes and stuff like that.
So when, let's say you've formulated this new joke and, you know, you think it's awesome. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've done, because I mean, like, I've messed around with trying to write jokes and stuff, and then in your head it sounds brilliant. And then when you actually try and say it, your delivery completely changes the way it comes out. So how do you vet material once you've written it?
Well, there's kind of two ways that I do it now. Is that I either take it to a sort of new material gig, you know, which is typically a gig that's either at a slightly smaller club or it's a club where they've said to the audience, this is new material, so they're kind of not expecting you to do your absolute gold and test it in front of an audience. Or the other thing I do now, which I'm doing more so, is writing with other comedians and kind of road testing material with other comedians. And that's something that I took way too long to start doing. I really, you know, I think just because stand-up's quite a sort of individualistic pursuit, I didn't really think you could be collaborative with it. And then one day one comedian just said, oh, do you want to get together and sort of do some writing? And I was like, yeah, maybe. And, you know, you're just so precious about your own ideas that... in front of an audience, it's quite an impersonal way to test an idea. You know, if 50 people don't like your joke, it's not much fun, but it's not a very personal way of people disliking it. Whereas if I'm just sat in front of you right now, Ricky, and I try one of my jokes on you, I'm looking at every muscle of your face for approval. Do you know what I mean? And so it's quite a daunting thing to start doing. But it's so helpful, and it just speeds up that process so much. So if I write a joke now, and I want to test it out, I've got to wait till the next new material gig. I've got to do the gig. After the gig, I've then got to listen back to the recording on my phone and try and really decipher how people laughed at it. Whether there is, as we spoke about earlier, a 20% of the room who did enjoy the joke. Maybe everyone hates it. Maybe there's 20% of the room that did enjoy it, so it's worth sticking with it, maybe tweaking it. Whereas if I'm just with another comedian whose opinion I trust and who's, you know, really good at writing themselves, I can just say the joke. And that whole, you know, that week-long process is shortened down to 30 seconds.
When you say the joke in that interaction, do you perform the joke or do you say the joke?
This is something I've got better at, because even that's quite a cringeworthy thing to do, isn't it? When you're in it, you know, when you're in a pub, especially. This is the worst, because most of the time I do it in pubs with people, and so that's even more embarrassing. If you're just in a quiet, if we're in my living room or something, it's not quite. But if we're in a pub, I've got to sit here perform. But yeah, I mean, it's more worthwhile to deliver it as you're going to deliver it on stage. And, you know, the first sort of few times I did do this, I was quite shy and a bit embarrassed. Yeah. So I just sort of mumbled through the joke. I went, no, it's not very good. Is it shit? I'll just cross it out. Whereas now I've got better at actually performing it a bit like I would do on stage and delivering it and putting the sort of pauses and the intonation. And if there is any physicality, you know, doing
the bare minimum of that, so it's not too embarrassing in the pub. But yeah,
I think you've skipped over something which is super important in that, which is pauses and how silence can kind of play a role in
massively. And I'll tell you what, you never notice that more than at a gig when you haven't got silence. So I mean, this is a big problem. Well, not a big problem, but this is an issue that a lot of people have at the Edinburgh Fringe. Nowadays, if people don't know what the Edinburgh Fringe is, it's originally a theatre festival in Edinburgh that is now the fringe aspect of it. It's mainly taken over by comedy. Loads of comedians go up there and do shows. You know, there's thousands and thousands of shows. And a big aspect of Edinburgh nowadays is the Free Fringe, which is where organisations, there's a few of them, they go around to sort of pubs and stuff, and they say to pubs, hey, if you've got, you know, a back room or something where we could maybe set up a microphone and stuff like that, we could run a programme of comedy throughout the whole Fringe. And, you know, you don't pay anything, we don't pay anything. As a comedian, you pay about 90 quid to be in that room. And, you know, it's not a theatre, but it's a decent enough room, you know, and a lot of time it works through. For me personally, that worked great. I was in the back room of a pub. I had a microphone, I had lights, I had proper seating. I didn't pay anything, the pub didn't pay anything. You know, the way it worked is that I had a space to perform. I was dragging in, you know, 50 or so punters every day for them. Everyone's happy. In some situations at the Fringe, you get rooms that aren't quite as good. And the biggest problem you sometimes find is noise bleed. And that's when you really find as a comedian, when you're trying to do something where you just need to build a bit of tension or you just need a bit of quiet, if you've got anything, whether it's a fan on the wall to cool people down. I mean, this is the problem about the Fringe being in August. Even in Scotland, it gets too hot, so you've got our fans and air conditioning. If you've got music playing next door, anything like that, it's a nightmare. And it's not even just having pauses that are clear, but the timing of those pauses and everything like that, that's something that you learn as you're doing it. And it's quite funny, like, because I spent the whole of August in Edinburgh. And then, so, I mean, we're now in the later days of September, and I spent 2 weeks at the start of September on holiday, came back, had food poisoning, and it was only last week that I started performing again. And while I was in Edinburgh, I got really, you know, just because I was doing stand-up every day, and also not just doing stand-up every day, because I do stand-up every day pretty much now, but I wasn't thinking about anything else. So I'd do my show, which was 40, 45 minutes. I'd then, you know, work on it, rewrite it, do other spots elsewhere, spend all day thinking about my material. And so I just got sharp with it, and I just got really, I knew where the pauses were. I knew how long to pause for. I knew all the intonation on all the words, everything like that. And then I went on holiday for 2 weeks, then spent a week off with food poisoning. And now I've come back. And the first gig that I did back last Thursday at Top Secret, where we met, I was there last week, and I'd forgotten where to pause within sentences to the point where I was running out of breath. I couldn't say, you know, I was ruining jokes. I couldn't say the last few words at the end of the sentence just because I'd forgotten where to pause within these jokes. It had completely gone out of my head.
I think it's really nice for people to hear, you know, because it is that much of a refined art once you, the material, and then it's the practice and practice and practice and practice. I assume that there's a huge difference between a short joke and a long joke on the basis that a long joke requires a lot more investment from the audience perspective. So if that flops, it's a bit more of a like knife to the heart in terms of you haven't got much or you drag them through a long experience to then for it to not to pay off. Whereas with a short joke, if it doesn't land, you're on to your next or whatever.
Yeah, I think a good way of writing the longer jokes is to have punchlines in there as if you were just telling a series of short jokes. And that's certainly how I try to do it. I think, coming back to Edinburgh again, but at the Edinburgh Fringe, there seems to be audiences that are a lot more patient. So you can go, you know, a little bit longer without punchlines, and they'll patiently listen, waiting for the joke to come. And as you say, in that situation, if you know, especially if you intend there to be jokes, you do, you know, if it does go wrong, it's a long way to wait till the next punchline sometimes. But I think what you're usually trying to do, whether it's telling, whether I was to tell a series of one-liners or whether I was to do stories and anecdotes as I usually do, you still want to get a laugh every, you know, whatever it is, 6 or 7 seconds or whatever.
That's incredible, isn't it? Over the course of a 45-minute gig.
Yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that I nailed that every day, but there were some tough shows. There were some seriously tough shows that I had out there. that I think you know, even within those longer jokes, you want to get the punchlines in. You want to get the punchlines in, and you do. You kind of build up a level of trust with the audience where, towards the end of a longer joke, you can go a bit longer without getting the laugh because they trust you, because they've learnt the rhythm of how you're speaking, and they're willing to stick with it for a bit longer because they're invested and there's going to be a payoff. But I think regardless of length of joke, you want it to be punchy, or at least I do anyway. That's the way I do it. I've always tried to just keep it punchy.
So part of being a comedian is obviously having to, in order to become successful, everyone bombs, I assume, and also you have to deal with hecklers. I wondered if you could share a few of your kind of more terrible experiences, either where someone's kind of called you out and it's been a hard heckle or whatever, or that experience of bombing hard, you know?
Yeah, I remember I bombed hard once. It was in Covent Garden. It was underneath an Italian restaurant, and it's been there a while. On it, I did this gig, and it was a while ago now. It was a really long time ago. Probably about 18 months ago. And I did it, and the sort of agreement that I had with the promoter was quite strange. It was like, he wanted me to do like seven to eight minutes, and in return he would give me £5 and a pizza. But I had to, buy me a pizza from the restaurant upstairs, that was it. The way he'd sort of structured the show is he had three of us comedians, and one would go on, then another one, then I'd go on, then there'd be a break, then I would go on again, and then the other two would go on, and then we'd get our pizza and our £5. And I remember I just bombed so hard with my first set, really, really badly. It just like to silence, absolute silence. Just, you know, like, it's quite a small room. It was like 30 people were just staring at me like, why is he talking about this? And I remember I sort of came off stage and I just had to say to the guys, I'm really sorry. I don't want a pizza enough to stick around for another set. And I just went home.
And what do you think that was? Just a wrong crowd?
I don't know, you kind of get taught, and I don't know who teaches us this, but you kind of get taught to think that there's no such thing as a wrong crowd and that there's always something you can do to make it work. And I definitely like to think that, I mean, some of the really best gigs I've done have been with crowds that I've at first gone, oh, maybe they're not going to like this, you know. And I think that's definitely when you feel a bigger level of accomplishment, is when you feel like you've overcome an audience that perhaps wouldn't have naturally taken to you. But I don't know what was wrong that night. I'll tell you what, not a long time, but if there was a few times when I'd have really big nights out and then have gigs the next day. And in my head, I thought they were going great, right? I wouldn't sleep. I'd stay up all night. I'd be in a right state. I'd have a quick shower. And a lot of the time, my mates would come with me and I'd go and do the gig. And I'd be like, oh my God, maybe I'm even better when I'm in this state. And then a couple of times, the people that would come and watch me at those gigs would then come and watch me at a gig where I wasn't in that state, and they'd go, oh my God, you are so much better when you've been to bed. And I realised that was probably a delusion, and those gigs probably weren't going as well as I thought they were. But there's been a few dodgy ones. I remember there was one that I did, and this was quite early on as well, and it was in a social club in Romford. And it was, wall-to-wall, St George's flags on the wall. I wasn't doing that material back then, but it was water, you know, it was that kind of vibe. Do you know what I mean? I hadn't been football on for months, but it was that kind of vibe. And I remember it was just savage. And it was someone's birthday. It was for someone's birthday party. And we got in there. I went into this social pub, and it looked a bit sort of rough and rowdy and stuff. And it seemed to mainly be drug dealers, or people who at least looked like drug dealers, and their girlfriends. And it was about 7 o'clock, and everyone was dancing. And there was a girl singing, and it turned out this girl was sort of like a local hero. She'd got through to the judges' houses on the X Factor a couple of years ago, and like every Friday night she'd sing, and every Friday night everyone would dance to her singing. And so she was, you know, giving it Adele and whatever, you know, and everyone was loving it and dancing, everything like that. And the landlord of this pub, it probably wasn't as dramatic as this, but in my head, he ripped the microphone away from her, made her sit down, and said, right, everyone stop dancing, stop having fun. We've got three comedians now, and you're going to sit and you're going to enjoy it. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, this isn't going to go well. And I was quite new and I didn't really remember a lot of my jokes, and I had some of them written on my hand and stuff. And I remember sitting there, and there was all these guys in tracksuits, they had dogs and stuff, and with their girlfriends. It was quite surly and scary, and I thought, this can't get any worse. And I noticed that the front two rows were empty. And now looking at the crowd, because they're a bit sort of rough and ready, I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll do some blue material, maybe I'll do some stuff about drugs or sex or whatever, and that'll get everyone on the side. But I just thought, why are these front two rows empty? And then someone went outside and went, kids, come in. And suddenly everyone's kids, so not only have I got the toughest crowd I could ever think of, but then their children come as well. So that get rid of everything I've written on my hand, that doesn't work now either. I didn't actually have time to wash the stuff off my hand, and I was on stage, and the heckles were just coming thick and fast. You could barely get a word out about someone, swearing at you, just putting you down. I remember one of them, someone spotted that I had stuff written on my hand, and they, sort of shouted out, went, what's that written on your hand? I didn't have anything, so I just said, oh, it's just my set. And they went, oh, lucky you didn't write that on your dick. That would have been a short set, wouldn't it? Genuinely, got a round of applause. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
But I remember after that one, I remember literally feeling like I should run to the train station.
Did you look back at it and laugh?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now I look back. And now I've done rooms like that now, and I've had a great time. And, you just... And I think rooms like that now are the ones that I enjoy a lot more. You get crowds that are a bit more weekendy, a bit more rough and ready in it. And that's the ones I really enjoy. The best ones, especially when I'm doing that St. George's Day material and stuff about nationalism, the best gigs I have are in front of bald guys covered in tattoos. Who I remember I did one, and there was a huge guy sat sort of second row, bald head, arms covered in tattoos. And he had this great big gold sovereign ring on his finger with St. George on it. And I sort of referenced him a few times within the material, and he was sort of enjoying it. And by the end of it, he was on stage and I kissed the ring of St. George on his finger. But I usually find them more fun than the more sort of chin scratchy kind of sort of quiet crowds. But back then I wasn't ready.
In the final segment of the interview, I wanted to ask Jacob for his advice for those starting out. I wanted to discover what is the best way, in his opinion, to get the ball rolling and to avoid some of the pitfalls that many fall into. What I'd like to talk to you about a little bit is for people that are kind of looking to transition into it. Obviously, now that you've been in the scene for a little while, you'll have a few insights for people. So if someone you knew wanted to start out today, what would you tell them to learn their craft like, and also how would you tell them to dip their toe in it, in the scene?
I think one thing that I did straight away that worked for me and helped me is, rather than going straight into my first gig having only watched stand-up comedy on television, or I'd been to see Ricky Gervais at the O2 and stuff like that, rather than having only seen that and then going into my first gig, which would have been a very small gig in a pub, I went and watched a lot of open mic or sort of entry-level comedy nights, and just learning that context, because that is completely different than Live at the Apollo or anything like that, learning what those rooms are like and what those people are like and how that kind of works, that just forearms you. And even in terms of your writing, you write stuff that works in those rooms, and you learn that just being able to reference something in the room and just being able to be quite interactive with the audience makes it much better, right? And interactive in a way that's different to the way that someone might do on Live at the Apollo or someone might do on a tour. So I think, get a taste of what you're actually going to be doing. Go and just see as much as you can, because I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years now, and even now I see people who do it in a way that I've never seen before. There are so many. It's such an open-ended performance type, art form, if you want to call it that. There's so many ways of doing it, and I think the best thing to do is to be as broad as possible in your research, because you never know what kind of comic you're going to be until you start doing it. And then I think just experiment with as many different things as possible. I think what I've found now is I do. I'm very much still, just starting to get off the absolute bottom ring of the ladder. But now I'm doing more gigs where I have to impress. I'm doing a spot maybe doing a small spot at a club where I'm trying to get a bigger spot, or I'm fortunate enough that I'm doing spots that are paid and, you know, and doing festivals and stuff like that and stuff where I've got people coming to watch me. And in those situations, I can't mess around. I have to do the best stuff I've got. And I can't try anything too weird or too different. Whereas when you're starting out, try everything. You know, any idea you've got, do it. Because
and when you first start out, how long are you expected to perform for?
Probably about 5 minutes originally. But then you always get these sort of strange, you know, mad gigs that are just coming out of nowhere where they suddenly want you to do an hour. And just do
even
it.
Even as a...
Yeah, you do. Well, I think because you're at that level and you're kind of looking for gigs where maybe, you know, not to say you're not supposed to look for them, but, you know, at that level you kind of think, well, I can't get into the clubs because, you know, they're oversaturated, there's waiting lists, you know, and it's hard when you start out. So you think you can't get into the clubs, so you think, well, I'll just do, you know, like what you did with the Comedy Society. You kind of find other places to do performances, you know. You say, oh, I tell you what, you know, it's my cousin's birthday in a few weeks. She's, you know, she's got DJs on, whatever. Maybe I'll do 20 minutes there. You just end up doing these weird things. I mean, I'm not saying that I did that. But you hear about people doing these things when they're quite new, and it's good. And I think that's really to be encouraged. I think, you know, and like I said earlier, one thing that I took way too long to do is start writing with other comedians. And now that's made, you know, in probably like the year or 18 months I've been doing that, that's made me so much better. And that's probably something that spans across every kind of, you know, creative industry or art form. Collaborative practice is always going to improve you. But I took way too long to do it. And, it, you know, don't be too precious with your ideas that you don't want to share them with other people, because it really, really helps.
And what are some of the things that you see new people messing up, I guess?
I think there's a lot to be said for learning very basic stagecraft and mic technique. That, you know, and it's such a silly place to slip up, you know, and such an unnecessary place to slip up when you know, just spend a little bit of time learning how to speak into a microphone, how to stand in the light on the stage, you know, just being aware of sight lines and stuff like that, because that's such an unnecessary way for it.
Let's teach people now. Give us the 2 minute condensed version.
Well, I mean, you know, like stay in the light, as simple as that. I mean, I mean, you know, with some mics it's slightly different. Most of the time you want to get it about, you know, an inch to 3 inches away from your mouth. Don't hold the top of the microphone, hold it at the bottom. A lot of the microphones that I end up using have got a slightly dodgy connection in the bottom, so I mean, I know one comedian who sort of wraps the cable around his hand a couple of times just so there's no tension on the bottom of the cable to stop that falling out. I just hold the bottom to stop that connection breaking. But the basic thing is just get to a venue a little bit early, ask the organiser or the MC if you can have a quick go on the mic just to find out how it does work. Do a little sound check for yourself when you get there. I mean, you know, turning up early and just being nice to people, that probably cut off a year of how long you have to do it before you get anywhere, because it just makes you someone that people want to work with. And I think that's, you know, don't be too surly, don't, you know, help out. Everyone's in it for the same reason. Everyone wants it to be a good night, and just, yeah.
It's great insight. Do you have any games or techniques that you use for practicing kind of improvisation and that kind of stuff?
Not as such. I mean, there's a guy that I write with. He's a comedian called Alex Farrow. He's based in Oxford, and he's brilliant. He's a really, really funny comedian. He runs some really good nights in Oxford as well, and we write together a lot. And he has a sort of game that he does with me that when I've got a new bit of material, and it's basically I don't know whether it's just the way that I write or the way that I perform, but with a lot of the material that I do, there's usually a sort of point behind it, or there's something that I'm trying to, not necessarily convince the audience, but there's an opinion that I'm trying to convey, an angle that I'm trying to get at. And he, you know, as I'm sort of telling him the material, he won't necessarily just say why, but he'll push me to convince him. So he'll push me to come up with more reasons why I think this thing, more examples of this thing happening or this thing, you know, occurring in practice. And that's one thing that we've done a few times that really helped push another bit of material. And it, you know, forum theatre is kind of like the sort of basic way that we perform our material to each other. So in terms of, we just, you know, we sort of start performing and he'll sort of pause, right, I'm not sure if that's working, blah, blah, blah. And that, you know, try this, all right, rewind, start again, that kind of basic way of doing it. But yeah, that thing that he does with me is quite helpful, where if he feels that I'm trying to convey a message or a point or opinion, he'll push me to, he'll be like, why do you feel like that? Why do you feel like that? Give me another example. Try harder. Push me more. I'm not convinced. And keep pushing like that. And that's helped a few times to get some quite good material out.
When you're actually on stage, how much do you find yourself actually pulling on any kind of improvisation, or are you mainly running off script in your head?
I do it quite a lot. I'm quite sort of in the room when I perform. You might notice it when you saw me, but I can't help but touch on things that are going on in the room. I don't know if it's, you know, slight ADHD or something that I did struggle at school and stuff like that. But yeah, I just find from my point of view personally, if especially if I'm an audience member, if I'm watching someone and something's happened in the room, if the performer on stage doesn't acknowledge it, I just can't move on from it. I'm thinking, why hasn't he? She, you know, she's noticed what's just happened in the room. Why hasn't she brought it up? Why hasn't he said something about it? And I think, you know, it builds a confidence with the audience and a trust with the audience. If you can spring off something and go, oh, look at that, ha ha ha, make a thing about it. Suddenly, you go through the roof. I mean, the best laughs you get are just from little things you've picked up on in the room and little, you know, quick quips that you can make about it. And that,
yeah, I watched an Australian guy, he wore a hat and he was bald underneath it, like his opening thing is that he kind of looked like Hitler, and but he just ripped into the audience for 20 odd minutes and had everyone in absolute stitches, and there was, like, you know, a few bits of his actual content and material in there, but the vast majority of his gig was improvisation. And you do, there is a massive respect for that, and I think, like you say, you get rewarded with better laughs as a result, in a way.
Yeah.
Finally, before I move on to some of the final questions, how does the financial side of all this stuff happen? So for people that are thinking about getting into it, what can they expect when they're starting out?
They can expect not a lot in terms of financial reward. They can expect to have to be quite creative.
£5 with their £5.
Yeah,
pizza.
Yeah, you've got to make that pizza last if you stick around for it. No, the fees are low. They're hard to come by. The best piece of advice is, that I've been given, is to keep your overheads as low as possible. I think that's probably the same as with any creative industry. But just keep your overheads low and then there's less risk. And yeah, just be creative in ways of making money. Make it happen for yourself.
What's the tipping point for people? Is it when they have got an audience that likes them enough that they'll come to their own gigs, or is it when you end up on TV? Like
I think those two things go hand in hand. I was from doing the BBC New Comedy Award over the summer. I was on the radio a few times, and I was on BBC iPlayer. But as a result of that, I had maybe a few hundred people that got in contact and said, oh, you know, we like this, we're keen to come and watch something. So from that, I can try and, you know, if I've got tickets to sell, that's a starting point. So I think whilst being on television, you know, obviously pays you a fee itself, there's also the exposure it gives you, and it opens the doors to another audience. And I think there's definitely something to be said for building your own live audience. You know, I think the traditional way of doing it would have been to work your way up with all the clubs, you know, whether that's the Comedy Store, places like Top Secret, you know, the Glees, the Jonglers, Highlight clubs that are all around the country. The traditional way to do it would have been to do sort of tryout spots at those clubs where you don't get paid anything. They go well, you do a few of them, then you get onto the paid bills. Nowadays, there's too many of us. There aren't enough clubs. And that, you know, for a few people, that's still the way they make their money. But I think now there's other ways of doing it, and there's other forms of media on top of television as well. I've been lucky enough recently that I've been doing a bit of stuff with UniLad, and just doing stuff with them opened my eyes to the fact. I mean, they're a Facebook page, and they've got offices that would, you know, it's unbelievable the amount of revenue in the. And I'm not, you know, that. They're also really awesome people to work with. I can only speak for UniLad, but I'm sure a lot of these other sort of, Facebook pages or whatever, I'm sure they're all great to work with. But UniLad specifically, the guys who work there, they used to run Don't Flop, which was a sort of battle rapping platform.
Up north, isn't it?
It was London as well, but it was, they used to run that, and now they run Unilad, and so some of the projects they're working on are incredible. I mean, the most recent one that I was a part of, it was during the Edinburgh Fringe. They flew me and a few other comedians out to Barcelona to partake in a poker tournament. It's PokerStars, PokerStars are like a poker organisation. This is one of the biggest tournaments in the world. There's a poker player called Daniel Negreanu.
Yeah.
Do you know? Yeah. So he's like the Cristiano Ronaldo of poker.
He's the Mystic Meg.
Exactly, right? He's got his own Netflix documentary, anything like that. So him and three others were partnered with us. So I was playing poker against this guy, and it's just amazing. And, you know, I think what we made was actually quite fun and quite funny. You know, loads of people watched it. And, you know, we played poker for about 2 hours. I had another poker player coaching me, a guy called Jamie, and then there was three other comedians. I should have won. I didn't win, but I should have won. But, yeah, it was great. And, that's another avenue you can explore. And there's, you know, I think, previously it was, you know, there was the clubs, there was TV. Now there's a million different ways you can do it. And comedian used to mean someone who stood on a stage behind a microphone and told jokes. Now it's so much broader than that, and there's so many different things you can do with it. And some of the most successful people I know are people who've done it themselves. I mean, I was aware of Daniel O'Reilly, a.k.a. Dapper Laughs.
That goes over my head, sorry.
Oh, do you not know who Dapper Laughs is?
No.
Do you not remember this from a few years ago? So he was a Vine star, and right. and he, in the end, it kind of self imploded because he sort of accusations of sexism and it, you know, all the videos he made got a bit nasty in the end. But he was huge. He ended up on Newsnight,
right?
that's how bad the meltdown was. But he started off as just a comedian, you know, on the sort of open mic circuit doing stuff like this. One day he got on Vine, picked up his phone, filmed himself doing something. It snowballed from there, and he's probably a millionaire now. And it's just from trying something a bit different. And don't get me wrong, I'm not condoning anything he did. A lot of those videos were absolutely awful. There was jokes about hitting women and all sorts of horrible stuff. But
he had an open mindset.
Yeah. I think you can appreciate the entrepreneurship, if not the content.
I've got some quick fire questions for you before I ask you my final question. I'll fire them at you. Favourite film or documentary?
Sexy Beast, the film.
Great one. Book or learning resource?
Oh, learning resource. I don't know about learning resource. I waste a lot of time on Wikipedia. My favourite book is The Wasp Factory.
Nice. What is The Wasp Factory, actually, just for to give people context?
I can't remember the fucking writer's called now. It's a Scottish guy.
Is it a novel? Or?
Yeah, a novel. Yeah.
All right, wicked. Newsletter people should subscribe to?
He's a comedian. He's also a sort of spoken word artist and a bit of a poet. He's called Rob Orton. His shows are absolutely fantastic. He focuses on like one subject and just makes a really inventive, cool show about them. So see him live. He does great spoken word as well. He's got some really nice stuff online. But his newsletter is even if you have no interest in him as a comedian or as a performer, his newsletter itself is something to behold. It's fantastic. So check out Rob Orton. He's great.
There you go. If you could name drop some of the best comedy clubs in London for people to check out.
As we've already mentioned, Top Secret Comedy Club is brilliant. It's growing so fast. I mean, it's literally growing. It's getting bigger all the time. But yeah, it's great. And it's got some fantastic, like, insanely good comedians dropped by there. I think Amy Schumer was there a few weeks ago, which is just unbelievable. Yeah. My absolute sort of favourite and my little home is Angel Comedy. In Angel, they've got two venues. One is the Camden Head on Camden Passage in Angel. The other one is the Bill Murray, which is a venue that they opened themselves. They were like sort of open mic night. They don't charge any ticket price. They just take donations in a bucket at the end. They save that up. They've actually bought a lease on a pub. They've named it the Bill Murray, and it's fantastic. I'd really recommend anyone to check it out there.
Other places outside of comedy clubs that you hang out at?
Pubs. I'm not much fun outside of comedy class. What else do I do? Where do I go? Yes, pubs, nightclubs, I guess. I go to a few clubs in London and stuff like that. Yeah, nowhere particularly.
Nowhere of note.
No, I don't have a look. I don't have enough time. That's the main problem. That's the only bad side of what I do is that it does eat your social life a little bit. Every now and then I go and watch Dulwich Hamlet football team in South London. Every now and then, but not as often as I like to.
Who are some of the other great young comedians that people should look out for, in your opinion?
Ooh, Kelly Convey, she's brilliant. Heidi Regan, Offaly Hockard. He's not as new as I am, but he's really, really, really good. A guy called Jordan Brooks. He had one of the best shows in Edinburgh. It's fantastic. Ahir Shah, who I mentioned earlier, is absolutely brilliant as well. The first three that I mentioned, Kelly Convey, Heidi Regan and Offaly Hockard, they're all absolutely brilliant. They're really good and you should check them out.
What's a great present for you?
The one I get the most is notepads. I always get notepads. Literally every birthday, every like anything like that, people go, I've got you a notepad to write down your comedy. And if anything, it's quite depressing because it just makes me think more about how I don't write enough. But a really good present for me is... I say about notepads, I could do with a nice pen. I haven't got a nice pen. I'd love a nice pen.
There you go. For anyone listening.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you the final question, and it's a little bit of a deep one. So if you had the opportunity to give the world one piece of advice to live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
I'd say it really is a question that I don't feel I have the authority to answer.
I make everyone do it, so this is the one that we'll have scribed.
Well, I don't know whether it's, you know, the most important thing in the world or whether it's... But it's just something that I started doing over the last year or so, or last few years, that's kind of made me in a bit of a better place productively and in terms of happiness, is the way that I value time over other things. So the way that I value time over money or just the way that I think about my time and what I'm doing and how I can get the most out of my time, but also... just give myself a little bit of leeway sometimes, because I can be a bit hard on myself sometimes, and I had a thing it was a while ago. I ended up basically going to the doctors, and this might sound really weird, I forgot how to relax, and that might sound really weird, but I forgot how to relax, and I went to the doctors, and I was really worried about it actually. Just because I couldn't watch TV anymore. I couldn't sit and do nothing. Because I just constantly had this guilt in the back of my head that I was wasting time. And I constantly, you know, I literally just couldn't give myself a break. I was constantly... And I spent more time beating myself up about not working hard enough than actually doing any work. And it made me much less productive. I couldn't really see it at the time. But I spent more time fretting and panicking and getting annoyed at myself for not working hard enough. And I've learned now just to give myself a few hours here and there, just to have a little, you know, fucking mosey and a little break. And yeah, it's not going to save the world. I don't think there's any saving the world where we are now. But that's one thing that's just helped me, is just being a bit more mindful in terms of how I spend my time and how I use my time, and being you know, smarter with it.
I actually think that's one of the more meaningful answers to that question.
Oh, God. What does everyone else say?
Well, it's just more a little bit more short and sharp, you know. Whereas I like the fact that you've backed it up with a personal experience, and it's something which I think a lot of people will resonate with. So,
yeah,
good response. Jacob, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for giving me all these insights on what it's like to be a comedian.
Thanks, man.
Best of luck for your future, and I'll come check you out sometime soon.
Please do. Thank you very much, Ricky.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London.
where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.